This podcast is for educational purposes only. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect the official policy or position of the Ted Stevens Center, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
Whitney Lochinbar, welcome.
Yeah, great to be here, bud.
So a while back, I'm not sure what quite the year, might have been 21, 22, you wrote a policy paper titled Threats Through to and in the Arctic, or something along those lines. Does that sound right?
Absolutely.
Something that you wrote? I want to dive into a little bit of that here today. Tell us what you were up to with this policy paper, and what's the difference between threats through to and in the Arctic? Because there's some important distinctions here.
Yeah, as I see it, it was partly my response to a long enduring debate extending back more than a decade with a colleague of mine in Canada, Rob Hubert. And we were known as sort of like a team who would be lined up as the yin and yang of Arctic security. And he'd often accuse me of singing Kumbaya, and I'd accuse him of being a purveyor of polar peril, as one of our other colleagues once described, which I thought was right on. But the ironic thing is we both agreed on the need for an increased Canadian Armed Forces and combined Canada-US presence in the Arctic. So it was my attempt to try and come up with a different way of conceptualizing Arctic security that took away from this broad amorphous term that seemed to cover everything. My worry is if something covers everything, fancy word would be tautology, yeah. It means everything, so it has limited utility for anything.
Right.
So breaking it down and suggesting, okay, some of the threats that we're talking about are actually global threats. And so the level of analysis is a really high sort of global one where threats will emanate or originate from outside of the North American Arctic. They'll pass through the North American Arctic to strike at targets outside of the North American Arctic. So the North American Arctic is important in terms of the entire detection kill chain for those kind of threats. But they're distinct from those threats that are actually looking at the Arctic as the destination or target.
So an example itself of this would be what?
So we could think of, you know, advanced hyperkinetic weapon systems, next generation cruise missiles, conventional cruise missiles for that matter, bombers that would fly over the Arctic. Primarily the destination is not the Arctic itself, certainly not in
Canada.
So
is this kind of a traditional Cold War example? Something's launched from Russia, passes over through the Arctic, over Canada perhaps, and lands in the United States?
Absolutely. Okay. So we can go back to the 1950s, for example. So pre-North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, this wonderful binational command that we have, partly being set up to address how we manage North American airspace and threats that at that time were conventional bombers that the Soviets would use because the circle routes, right, the shortest distance between a base in the Soviet Union and, say, Chicago or New York or Ottawa, for that matter, is going to be flying over the pole. Mm-hmm. So how do you mobilize strategic defense in depth in a North American context? So set up, say, the distant early warning or dew line extending from Alaska, you know, through the Canadian north over to Greenland, and by extension even over to Iceland. Mm-hmm. So you can mobilize those interceptor fleets, in the 1950s at least, you know, from bases in the continental U.S. or southern Canada to come and intercept. So this is not a new problem set, but it's important in thinking that the dew line, the distant early warning line, wasn't created to defend the Canadian Arctic,
right,
or defend Alaska. It was to defend the continent. So when we talk about Arctic security, I think, yeah, the Arctic is important to overall continental defense and overall global deterrence. But that's a different conversation in my mind than threats that are targeting the Arctic itself. So targeting our communities, targeting our populations. In the U.S., you do have, we're here at, you know, J-Bear, Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. You do have really major bases where you're pre-positioning forces, I would say not even primarily for the Arctic, but the Indo-Pacific, you know, theater, that are here that would be a target. So we do have some conventional military threats to Arctic destinations in North America, for sure. When we move to Canada, though, I say we don't have a concept where we're forward-basing a lot of our forces in northern Canada, precisely because of the globe and the nature of where we typically deploy our forces. So when I think of threats to the Canadian Arctic, they're predominantly not kinetic military threats. So they're not nuclear or conventional long-range, you know, targeting. There are some Canadian military installations, sure, in the north. Certainly our Canadian forces stationed alert on the northern tip of Ellesmere Island,
right,
doing electronic surveillance.
80 degrees north.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if there was going to be a generalized war, that's probably something that would be advantageous for adversaries to want to
target. But not on the everyday.
But not on the everyday. I mean, when we look at what kind of threats we're facing really right now and are emerging, a lot of them are noticed below the threshold or hybrid threats that I'm happy to dive into. So again, it's thinking about who then will address this broader suite of security threats that we're facing to the Arctic itself. And this is part of more general competition that I think we're all very much alive to these days.
So through example, ballistic missile, we're kind of thinking, put yourself back in the Cold War era, still relevant today, but maybe not as talked about, perhaps because we're starting to see the emergence of more hybrid, maybe below threshold attacks, which then therein lies sort of this notion that maybe some of the stuff in Canada is actually not more exposed, but certainly exposed to threats that maybe we wouldn't have seen in the past because of the nature and the ease in which some countries can deploy hybrid war. Is that a fair assessment?
It is, and I think it's also the proverbial don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We certainly have enduring threats to North America as a whole. So we've heard, you know, General O'Shaughnessy, a former NORAD U.S. Northern Northern Commander, often talking about Fortress North America mindset is no longer applicable. All of his successors have echoed that sentiment. It's very, very true. So we need to think about those threats, including the missile threat. And we can get into more details on how Canada has had hesitancy to join in to U.S. ballistic missile defense programs since the early 2000s. I think that time is over. We're already involved in the detection systems.
Something we'll come back to in a second.
So those are still very real. Certainly for Canadian audiences, though, I suggest that we have certain capabilities more broadly, particularly in partnership with the United States, that defend North America. We are aware, and it's very public, that some of the delivery systems that our adversaries and competitors are coming online with, we're not equipped right now to deal with. So we're investing heavily as Canadians in NORAD modernization. So the capabilities that we need within this shared binational, we can talk even about binational, it's a unique command relationship reflective of this unique partnership and alliance that Canada and the U.S. have embodied in NORAD. We need to modernize and enhance those capabilities to deal with these emergent threats, very much in the conventional military domain.
Sure.
But we also have this other suite of threats, you know, to subsea infrastructure, preying upon populations, trying to go and polarize our populations as well, to turn them against the state, to lose faith in the state, both acquire certain economic advantage or deny certain economic competition. There's this whole suite of different things that are playing out. That I find
kind of
really
things that we see were playing out in many places here, domestic polarization of societies that start to pull the society apart from within. In some ways, can be considered a hybrid threat, depending on how that is.
Absolutely.
That is through information warfare, cyber warfare, otherwise, certainly can apply to Canada. We're seeing it in Europe, see the United States attacks on critical infrastructure. We've seen that in the United States, whether it's a pipeline or within the. I think even some of the outages of what was it, the airport systems that went down. I'm not sure if that was an actual attack or not, but sort of emblematic of what one might look like if indeed something went down. I want to come back to some of this stuff, but I want to complete sort of this notion of through to and in. So let's go to in, threats in the Arctic itself, and then we'll come back to some of the stuff that we had just mentioned, like critical infrastructure and the binational nature of NORAD and why that's important and why that's relevant for the future. So let's talk about in.
And I'm going to do that by setting up using climate change as an example.
Yes.
If we're scaling up climate change as a global phenomenon, the Arctic is warming at a rate, Canada, we say, at least four times the global average. The drivers of that climate change are not within the region itself. It's not greenhouse gas emissions from Alaska or from the Canadian Arctic that are leading to that temperature change and the warming in the region. Those are coming outside. So on the one hand, we can think about climate change as a threat to the Arctic. But when we think about the implications of climate change, these are within the region. Mm. So we can think about permafrost degradation, what that means for airstrips, what that means for certain types of above-grade infrastructure. When we think about melting of sea ice and what that means in terms of different patterns of shipping activity. And I think there's some misconceptions around that in a North American context we can come back to. But these are within the region, you know, amplifying risks of, say, a cruise ship running aground and what capabilities we would have in place to be able to respond.
Yeah.
Since the end of the Cold War, we've seen the Arctic routes used for volumes of commercial aircraft that were almost unimaginable if we get back to the 1980s and before. So what happens if a major air disaster, a MAJ-8 incident occurs, and our ability to respond? We can also think about challenges facing Indigenous peoples and other Northerners, Alaskans, you know,
sure,
finding stressors to different types of food sources and so on. So again, different category of threats. You know, you mentioned pipelines and so on. There sometimes are inside threats that
right,
we have state apparatus to deal with. But for the most part, I see these as being human security, environmental security type challenges. So, you know, we think of DISC emissions in a U.S. context,
yeah,
so domestic support
to
civil authorities,
yeah,
or HADR, we call it, humanitarian and disaster response, mm-hmm, you know, in terms of those mission sets. So there are these challenges as well. And I would say for many Northern peoples, these are actually the most acute day-to-day pressing challenges.
Right.
So part of the way of thinking about through, to, and in is not to set it up as an or equation. In fact, it's all about striking the right balance of being able to address all these different baskets of threats simultaneously. And part of why I came up with this construct was to get away from setting it up like it's an either or. If all Arctic security is one basket, I'm going to probably be arguing that when we're facing acute human security needs in the North, that's where we have to be directing our energy. But that's irresponsible if it means that we're negligent in addressing what are also yeah, really important national defense, defense of the homeland type challenges. So we can walk, we can, you know, walk, chew, and eat gum, you know, at the
right,
same, or chew,
right,
chew gum at the same time. Pardon me, eat gum. Don't swallow the gum. Don't swallow the gum. But walk and chew gum at the same time. In this case, yeah, it's managing this as all important challenges.
Well, it seems to me that that you've been at this a while. And by this, I mean Arctic security, the field of Arctic security. And what I kind of pick up when I sit here and digest some of this is that if somebody were to say what is Arctic security, they might immediately just think geographically you draw a circle around roughly the Arctic Circle, 60 degrees north, 66 degrees north, however you want to geographically define the Arctic region, and say that is Arctic security. Whatever happens there is Arctic security. And what you're saying is yes, and it's the things that go through it, it's the things that come out of it, it's the things that are in it, and it's more, which this basically means that Arctic security is what happens in the Arctic, but it's also how it impacts the rest of the world as well. And so this
absolutely,
is, to me, I can kind of see this logical connection then, if we use your framework here of through, to, and in. And so I kind of want to take that then and use that example to say, okay, we're talking Arctic security, but it's not just about the Arctic. And we had mentioned hybrid war. And actually, just this week, there was an intriguing yet somewhat murky story about undersea cables being cut that run between what was it called, Central Europe and Finland.
Yes.
These were fiber optic data cables in the Baltic Sea. Immediately afterwards, it was somewhat presumed. I think there was a multinational statement that came out that alluded to this being intentional, which I think if you read between the lines, there's an actor that they believe did it, likely Russia. Then I think even today or yesterday, maybe it's not Russia, it was China. Some sort of malign intention by perhaps a nation state or somebody supported by one. And Boris Pistorius, the defense minister of Germany, mentioned that no one believed that it was an accident. Because accidents do happen. I think I read somewhere mm-hmm. that about two cables are cut a week. So I guess if you aggregate that over the year, that's you know,
100 plus
cables being cut. So you could see where there's some gray area here. Well, maybe it could have been an accident. Well, apparently Minister Pistorius didn't think it was. Either which way, seems as if many are framing this as an attempt to undermine democracy when you attack critical infrastructure systems, sabotage or otherwise. Notably in this context, what I think the Europeans are trying to say here is that it's targeting countries that are supplying critical equipment to fight the war in Ukraine. Now, this isn't a deliberate, necessarily a fatal or lethal attack on any particular society. And again, I'm not talking about Canada here. I'm talking about somewhere else. But presumably this could happen in Canada, because last I checked, Canada is supporting the effort towards the war in Ukraine. So here we have an example of some sort of hybrid war, or at least what many presume would be categorized as hybrid war. Is this kind of what you're talking about as a a potential threat to the Canadian infrastructure, or what might you make of this particular incident here?
So I love it because I think it allows me to sort of play on various themes. First of all, it's when we talk Arctic. We often do this, but again, that can mean different things. Are we talking the Arctic as a truly circumpolar space, of which the largest percentage of that Arctic is Russian? We acknowledge it is actually Russian sovereign territory. We're talking landmass and extensions of maritime areas where Russia has certain rights, say a continental shelf, so the seabed extending out into the Arctic Ocean. In this case, we're talking about Northern Europe, so what's often described as the European High North. Mm-hmm. Lots of infrastructure, subsea infrastructure. This is the this particular incident occurred in the Baltic Sea. It's not the first time we've seen this. Last year, Nunu Polar Bear, Russian sort of confusing vessel that just happens to be dragging its anchor
just
through,
so
and tearing up,
yeah.
And then darts back through the Northern Sea Route, which is the sea artery sort of flowing north of Russia to get out of being able to actually be enforced. The challenge with these kind of incidents is that they're very difficult to attribute.
Right.
So in essence, it's hard to assign responsibility, and it also has our competitors, and in this case, I would say adversaries, deliberately operating in an area that's below which we typically would have drawn a red line to have a military, a kinetic response.
If you could attribute it, you could say, well, it was an accident, right? So it's hard to attribute, and then if you could, you could say, well, okay, fine, but I didn't mean to, I'm sorry, you know, it was an accident, the captain should have known better, I wasn't dragging the anchor on.
And I think what this is showing is contestation, where we're being pressured to define our red lines, mm-hmm. and in a way, figure out how you deter. Are we deterring by punishment? We're not really able to punish somebody in a conventional sense for this. So we're seeking deterrence by denial, the other form of, but what does it look like to be able to deny adversarial actors who are not, this isn't a Russian naval vessel who's coming
right
through and blowing up, you know, subsurface infrastructure. We have to be able to detect it. We need to anticipate where this is gonna happen. It's low signature. Mm-hmm. Difficult to attribute, a military conventional response is not going to fit. So our adversaries are testing us, and they're testing us on an ongoing basis. I think the challenge where I sort of introduced with the Arctic and how we think about, is it circumpolar or is it a sub-region of the Arctic? Mm-hmm. These are dynamics we're seeing play out in the European High North.
Sure.
Do we see these same activities playing out in the North American Arctic, or I'm from Canada, so the mm-hmm. Canadian Arctic? Not yet. And maybe not ever, depending on the nature of the infrastructure we have or our adversary's willingness to test us and disrupt us in our homeland. But this is something that is really at the forefront when I think about Arctic security and what Ted Stevens Center and other expert groups need to be working on as problem sets, to think about this as something that is not a future possibility, but a clear and present dynamic we're on right now.
You'll be familiar with this adage. For long times, it seemed to be the Canadian position, not official position, but a position nonetheless, that it's you know, an invasion of Canada would turn into a rescue mission, right? Well, okay, be that as it may, an example that you're putting here is that these hybrid threats could come to Canada, and they might not ever come to Canada. But I'd imagine it doesn't sell very well to say our plan is that we'll never come here, so we don't need
yes.
to prepare. It seems as if Canada might be in that particular position now, and I want to.
So we have seen them, and if I may, just a piece, and again, it's expanding our definition of what we think about as security. But cyber attacks, not attributed to a hostile nation-state actor, but some other, you know, predatory actor, maybe operating out of Russia or whatever, going and doing cyber attacks on health systems. So being able to freeze out, doing a cyber hostage type situation, if you will, holding data hostage. Maybe it's for a financial gain. Maybe it's to be disruptive and undermine confidence in systems. Take your pick. Mm-hmm. It has both effects, actually. But if we broaden that out, those kind of cyber attacks, to me, are an example of a threat, a direct attack to Arctic security. The question then becomes, what do we require as Arctic-specific solutions to those versus more general national or allied solutions to cyber attacks broadly? But then also think about how in the Arctic, we often have systems without a lot of redundancy, single points of failure and so on. So in order to actually grapple with these things, I think we have a lot of interesting work to do as well to identify what are the Arctic aspects of these threats that we need to be grappling with, and is the military the instrument to be dealing with threats on health infrastructure and data security and so on, or how do we then situate our respective defense establishments within this broader whole of society, whole of nation, whole of government, interagency type dynamic?
I mean, it's a fascinating way to frame it, because it sort of blows past the sort of the traditional way of looking at it, where, okay, we have a military that's going to protect us from military threats, traditional military threats, kind of like we started. Okay, they got a ballistic missile, can fly a long ways. We got to come up with hard military infrastructure to ensure that we can protect ourselves. Let's have an army and a navy. But now we're talking about things that are not necessarily military, or at least known to be that way, attacking again, kind of in air quotes, non-military targets that still impact the society.
Absolutely.
And we could go on about that, but I want to switch to something here. You mentioned allies in what you just talked about. Canada's part of NATO. NATO is supporting Ukraine and its war, in Ukraine's defense of its sovereignty and its in the war against Russia. That war just passed 1,000 days, and it seems lately that Russia is making some advances there. Recently, the U.S. authorized use of long-range weapons to strike in Ukraine, and then the United Kingdom did the same. And then it seemed like overnight, somehow, the Russia changes or loosens, one might say, its nuclear policies, right? And then threaten to target countries that supply Ukraine with weapons. And again, Canada is amongst this group of countries that is supplying Ukraine with weapons. The president of the Halifax Forum, which happens to be going on now, and last I checked, Halifax is in Canada.
So this definitely is.
Is a Canadian forum, said this. He said he wants to change the narrative that Russia is winning, saying that allies led by the United States, which is interesting seeing what has just happened with the American election, which maybe we'll get into it in a second, allies led by the United States need to push Russia out of Ukraine, yet at the same time, and this is me speaking now, just based on some of what has been said, it seems as if, and I'm curious for your opinion on this, that the U.S. might be pulling out some of that support. It's not any official position, but
many of us are waiting to see what the outcome will be in
exactly.
a few months. Time.
So here's an event happening in Canada, an important security conference in Canada. I don't know if Trudeau is going to be there or not, but on display will be sort of what the Canadian position is on this, and perhaps what the Canadian psyche is on the American position on this. I figured you might have some thoughts on how this is transpiring.
Well, I'll spin it in a way and suggest that I think the timing more than ever, you know, behooves us as allies, and I'm talking both Canada, US, and then the member states of NATO, to retain solidarity. And I think the more that there are assurances over the next few months that we're not going to be divided, we're not going to splinter, is going to be very helpful. It's going to be essential. Mm-hmm. It's going to be really important for us to have synchronized strategic messaging so that we're not misunderstood. So again, whatever the decisions may be of individual member states like the United States, you know, within this space, we need to be demonstrating that we actually do have strength. And I think sometimes, and I'm going to pull this back, for example, in Alaska and in Canada, you'll often get certain voices speaking about our relative weakness or vulnerability compared to Russia. We love to talk about icebreaker gaps, for example. Russia has, you know, 50 plus, I'm making up a number here, but 50 plus icebreakers. We don't, you know, we only have a couple that are functional, which is often an underrepresentation.
And there's a lot of nuance here. Not all icebreakers are made the same.
Exactly. And they serve different purposes. Yeah. But the point being, we often downplay what capabilities we have. When we're looking to Russia, what I hear in the quote that you gave is, we need to be demonstrating our strength. The world has never seen an alliance like NATO. We are the strongest alliance the world has ever seen. Even with Russia and China starting to indicate, including in the Aleutians and elsewhere, that they're working together, This is a transactional relationship. It is not a relationship anywhere close to what certainly Canada and the U.S. enjoy as truly premier partners. Sharing command, binational command, seamless between us when we talk about aerospace and maritime warning by design. This is important to signal. So again, getting back to what's going on in Europe, what I hear here, it's very important for us to not suggest, because we're trying to sell for political reasons, that we're vulnerable and therefore we need investment, that that not be miscommunicated as suggesting that we are incapable of collective action. And I think that's the point here is, when we have alliance solidarity, we are truly unprecedented and absolutely have absolute strength, even in the face of some of these emerging technologies.
And so we'll there'll be pressure on the Trudeau administration at the Halifax conference to, what I'll put in quotations here, pony up. There was an article written on the Canadians needing to pony up, again, attributed, put that in the aftermarks here, but funds to modernize its Arctic infrastructure. And a colleague of yours, Heather Exner-Perot, stated accurately, one might assume that the Americans are, quote, now pretty busy on the Pacific and Atlantic side, and they'd sure like to see it Canada covered the Arctic. Now, I think what she's maybe assuming here is that there's the war in Ukraine, and there's the war, not war in the Pacific, but there's China in the Pacific, and then here's the Arctic. And then the Arctic is, as you sort of alluded to, there's Russia, there's China, and there's kind of Russia and China now. As we sit in Alaska, we see that front and center. Is it time for Canada to, again, quote, pony up? Is this where maybe Canada could pull a little more weight?
Absolutely. In April of this year, we had the release of a defense policy update called Our North Strong and Free, so playing on one of the lines in our national anthem, that really did have an unprecedented northern and Arctic focus. And I say unprecedented, not lightly. I'm a historian by training. We've never seen anything like this in terms of an emphasis suggesting that we often talk about Arctic sovereignty. I think it's actually misphrasing. What we're really talking about is Arctic security being a primary contribution that we're making to the western and northern flanks of NATO and the Canada-US alliance. So we've seen commitments of money to enhance NORAD modernization as early as 2019, and our previous defense policy and announcements made by ministers of national defense since that time. This is going beyond that and promising additional capabilities, including Northern Operational Support Hub, so some of this infrastructure that Dr. Exner-Perot was referring to. These are commitments that we've made. I know there's going to be a lot of, some listeners might say, but Canada didn't have a plan in April to reach 2% of GDP as we've committed to as a NATO member. Since that time, we have indicated that we are seeking to modernize our submarine fleet, which will take us over the 2%. The challenge is its timelines, that in order for us to procure systems in Canada, it takes us forever. I know there's complaints about the U.S. procurement system. Trust me, compared to the U.S. one, Canada's is really, really challenging, even more so. It's going to be actually, making sure that those investments and that infrastructure is built at the speed of relevance to deal with these emerging defense threats and security threats. And at the same time, a lot of commitments in Canada to see these smart defense investments have civilian benefits, help to address what are very chronic Arctic infrastructure deficits in Canada, and that might be a topic of conversation as well, because certainly Alaskans feel a lot of that pain as well.
And I kind of want to pause and make an important distinction here. We throw around some of these terms, NATO, NORAD, sort of as if they're synonymous, but they're not. They're related, but they're distinctively different. Canada is part of both of them, and NATO and NORAD. Okay, so I just want to take a minute to clarify this, that there's a NATO in 2% commitment gets thrown around a lot. Many are familiar with the, I believe, I don't know what the letter actually says specifically, but it's a suggested mark that a nation meet, 2%. Okay, the more the better, some might say. That's NATO. Now, Canada's part of NATO, and Canada is also an Arctic country. I'm getting somewhere with this. Canada is also part of NORAD, which is a binational command with the United States, different from NATO, but the United States and Canada are both part of NATO. So how might one understand if Canada decides to update or modernize its capabilities in Arctic infrastructure that might apply to NORAD? Would NATO benefit from that? Walk us through this a little
Absolutely bit. Love it. So Canada and the United States are both founding members of the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, so NATO, which is partly designed to provide guarantees to our European allies. If we think back to 1949, the Cold War was just hardening. Reassurance that we were still committed to that North Atlantic lifeline. Given that we have NATO allies, the Kingdom of Denmark, which includes Greenland, Faroe Islands, Norway, now very recently Sweden and Finland joining NATO. But that means that the Arctic has always been part of NATO's area of operations, not also including the North American Arctic, the Canadian, U.S. Arctics, and Greenlandic Arctic. So it's always covered that. It also is a provision within NATO that you can have regional security alliances within. Mm-hmm. So it's not covered by the Canada-U.S. North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, stood up in 1957-58, which is binational, meaning it's not just bilateral where we get to pick and choose. We're in this together. Our decisions are made mutually. It's both the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Canada who have authority within the NORAD construct. This is our way as Canada and the U.S. Historically has been our way of demonstrating our preference that we can manage the North American part, even if we want to see it as the North American flank of NATO. We don't need the Committee of the Whole. We don't need the 30 European nations to come and help us. We can cover this off ourselves, particularly in the aerospace and maritime warning domain. Where I think investments in NORAD are now being reframed is that this is contributing to NATO's western flank. So think the approaches to Alaska, the approach to North America, from the west, from Russia, and then also northern flank. So this is suggesting that for certain delivery systems, the natural area of approach is actually from the north. Mm. So investments that Canada and the United States are making in modernizing NORAD, I would argue inherently also bolster and enhance NATO. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the questions right now is, how is information being shared between NORAD, so Canada, US, binational command, with the rest of NATO, and with NATO taking more of an interest in Arctic defense? Mm-hmm. What does that mean in terms of rethinking or reconceptualizing how these different components of the alliance actually work together?
And so what does it mean then?
So one of the questions you brought up before, the quote from Dr. X Shapiro talking about Indo-Pacific and Europe. So within the U.S. combatant command structure, you've got an Indo-Pacific command, Indo-PACOM. Mm-hmm. So focusing on emerging threats, and you can think Russia falling within that. You can think of China within that basket. You've got European command, which starts actually just west of Greenland. So what I would say is actually geographically part of North America is almost severed off to be part of European command, right, precisely because of Greenland being a country that's part of the Kingdom of Denmark, right? But then you've got these lines that we can also consider to be gaps and seams. So European command is dealing with Russia right there, on its border, and a desire that the U.S. has communicated for the European allies to take on more of that responsibility with vis-a-vis Russia and Europe, so that the U.S. can focus on that pacing threat, so that long-term existential threat that China poses. In between that, you've got U.S. Northern Command, which happens to have an area of responsibility that maps, at least in the northern part of North America, directly with NORAD. Mm-hmm. So we actually have Colorado Springs, where NORAD headquarters and U.S. Northern Command headquarters are actually in the same building.
Right.
So from that standpoint, we can think about how that combatant command structure, I hope listeners can kind of visualize this, how we're making sure that these lines that are drawn don't become vulnerabilities, where we have adversaries who are going to poke and prod and try to test whether we're actually able of acting in an integrated fashion across these combatant commands. So with getting back to your question about NATO and NORAD, right, very much the European command and Northern command combined interests are clear. But what we're seeing emerging very much is this connection between the Indo-Pacific and the Arctic as well. So I think everything's coming into play and making sure that we're not creating gaps or seams that are exploitable is to me one of the real major challenge questions that we're grappling with right now.
So it's safe to say a Canadian investment in Arctic infrastructure, be it directly towards NORAD modernization or even to bring it back to what we talked about earlier, you know, shoring up critical infrastructure, investment in that would also be an investment in NATO in some capacity because it strengthens that particular flank, I guess, to use that, or area, whatever you might want to call it, of the alliance itself. And
absolutely,
traditionally for a long time, it was, hey, we got this over here, the North American side of it, we got this. And that still remains the same, but maybe not quite the same because the geopolitical context has changed. And what I mean by that is we're starting to see more geopolitical activity in the Arctic, some of which is coming from, and here we go to this other theater now, that your colleague Heather mentioned, you and I have talked about many times, the Indo-Pacific, mm-hmm. last year enters China into the conversation. You've already mentioned it a little bit. And I don't need to remind people about geography. Canada is a Pacific country. So there
Absolutely.
Is interest in this theater. So I guess I started with the question, you know, is that investment, is that logic correct? An investment into that would be...
It is, and I think it's seeing that the Arctic cannot be, if we think of our mental maps, it can't be separated from the rest of the world. We're once again returning to this awareness that it's inextricably, inescapably implicated in global competition. So when we think about deterrence, and again, I mentioned before sort of the notion of deterrence by punishment or deterrence by denial. Some of the comments made by the commander of U.S. Northern Command, who has also had it as the commander, it's a U.S. four-star general, also double-hatted as the commander of NORAD, mm-hmm. with a Canadian deputy commander on the NORAD side. They often sort of emphasize the importance of thinking about continental defense and North American defense as being connected with broader global defense, and this notion of deterrence by denial, mm-hmm. as being something that we've not invested in as much as deterrence by punishment. What I mean by that for the audience is deterrence by punishment is that you have an adversary who wouldn't hopefully think or dare to come and attack you because the amount of harm and pain that you could unleash on them in response. means it's too much. We've been doing that for a long time in terms of that being a fundamental concept that we've maintained. The challenge becomes, what about deterrence by denial? Not having to suffer or sustain that initial pain or harm by being able to stop them and prevent them from coming and doing that. So within that construct, it's thinking about now as we see delivery systems that our adversaries are developing, moving faster than our ability to detect, never mind defeat, how do we reconceptualize how we deter them? Mm. And partly it's suggesting that we can defeat some of those launch platforms before they even leave the launch position. Mm. This requires a globally integrated framework in which the Arctic is part. So again, hopefully not too confusing in putting this sort of visions together, but it's now also seeing the Arctic and Arctic defenses and NORAD modernization as contributing to this global posture. And certainly one of the main themes coming out of U.S. Northern Command NORAD is about the importance of information dominance. Wars are going to be won or lost in the 2020s and beyond based upon your ability in a timely way to pull in, ingest information, fuse the information, process it, and allow for decisions faster than your adversaries. So the more that we have detection systems set up in the Arctic and elsewhere that are feeding into this common picture, the more we're able to achieve that information dominance and make decisions faster than anybody else.
And this construct even relates to what we opened with the through to an end, where for a while it was, all right, you wouldn't dare do something to me because if you slap me, I would punch you, you know, and okay,
yes.
I guess it's not worth it. And then it was, all right, I know the slap is coming, I'll stop it, or if you
yes.
will, I'll shoot it down from the sky. And now what you're saying is that a country might have the ability to say, well, we can't wait for it to start. We have to stop it from starting to begin with, which means that perhaps you have to come out of the Arctic to prevent something from emanating from outside the Arctic to even get to it or to get through it.
Love it. So in a Canadian example, something that we have committed to, it's a major project and a contribution to NORAD modernization, but I would argue to NATO as a whole as well, is both polar and Arctic over-the-horizon radar. And viewers might think, like, they sound like the same thing. No, actually, the Arctic over-the-horizon radar will be based in southern Canada, presumably southern Ontario, where I'm from, so south of actually where you were born and raised, you know, ironically. But it would then extend coverage out throughout the Canadian Arctic, so the North American Arctic. So that coverage is provided from a relatively southern location that provides Arctic defense or continental defense within space. The polar over-the-horizon radar, and I hope I haven't got these ones backwards, but it's going to actually be based in the Canadian Arctic and project out and provide coverage over the pole entirely. So think about who's across the pole, who's over there. We're talking Russia, we could talk parts of northern China. So from that, North Korea. So from that standpoint, you're extending outward your coverage. So it's using Arctic-based infrastructure, but again, to extend that reach. And ideally, by having that information dominance, once again, the same logic holds, it's deterrence because your adversaries won't think that they can get away with something. They won't think that they can launch a first strike or they can take some kind of activity without you knowing it to catch you blindsided. So by having more, more eyes on things, right, it gives us that kind of advantage. So even there, it's thinking about the Arctic in kind of layers, both regional defense, but then also as part of broader global defense.
And ideally, these would be integrated, these radars would be integrated with the other radars that exist in other countries. And as, if we look at geography, notably in the Arctic, you know, many of them are, all of them, minus one, are part of NATO, and I should maybe say progressively integrated, as many of them already are.
Yes, absolutely.
I want to switch as we get maybe towards the end here. You've come up to Anchorage, we're here in Anchorage now. You came up for the Anchorage Security and Defense Conference. And at the conference, we noted that it's the gateway to the Arctic, yes, here at about 61 degrees north, but also the Pacific. Yeah. And last month, you and I had the opportunity to sit on a panel at the Arctic Circle Assembly. I think we called it Arctic Connected. And we attempted to connect the Arctic to other places in the world. And for that particular panel, we looked towards the Indo-Pacific.
Yeah.
I mentioned a few minutes ago, Canada is, in fact, a Pacific country. In an increasingly interconnected world, I don't necessarily mean globalization. What I mean more is interconnected, where an event in the security realm seems to have impacts in and around the world.
Absolutely.
We could connect dots. I think we made this connection yesterday of Iranian drones being sent to Russia and Russia helping the Houthis and the Houthis, you know, attacking ships through the Red Sea. And then that's going to divert shipping, which one might surmise could push shipping north, perhaps through the Bering Strait along the Northern Sea Route. And suddenly we're talking about, you know, starting in one place in and near the Middle East. And suddenly we're talking about the Arctic. China and the Arctic. You and I have talked about this quite a lot. What are we to make of it? It's pretty open-ended because I think it is open-ended. And I don't want to be too specific because we can say, well, they got this many icebreakers or they've done this types of research or they're entering into a certain type of arrangement with the Russians. But I think it's better to be open-ended now because there are a lot of ways to understand this.
So racing through a bunch of ideas and then we can sort of pick away and parse them as you would like. First of all, recognizing China is not a peer competitor in the Arctic. And I say that, and I've written about this, because they're not a peer in the Arctic. They're not a peer, they don't have Arctic territory, they don't have status where they can come and operate in the vast majority of the Arctic without basically the invitation and cooperation partnership with the Arctic states. So first of all, I think we sometimes overinflate China's status within the region, and my worry is that plays directly into the preferred status of Beijing, not ours. We are the Arctic states. We have sovereignty or sovereign rights.
So perhaps message one is to don't over
and don't treat them or talk about them like they're a peer.
Okay.
You know, the Arctic five coastal states have a certain basket of rights that we uniquely have. The Arctic states, Arctic eight, so the member states of the Arctic Council also have rights to which China does not have. So first of all, that's a key message. Secondly, we should not be shocked that China has interests in the Arctic. They have global interests. They have global aspirations. The Arctic is part of the globe. When you talk of shipping, when you talk of resources, it's not a surprise. So I think sometimes we almost think like, with the gas. Like, why would they be interested here? Well, of course they're interested
global
here.
Global aspirations, yes. You need to be global.
You need to be global. So, yeah, are they interested in Arctic shipping routes and those opportunities? Of course they are. Are they interested in Arctic resources? Well, yes. And they've got much more of a foothold in the Russian Arctic, particularly Yamal Peninsula, than they have anywhere else. I think one of the stories that's not often talked enough about is how the seven like-minded Arctic states have all awakened to the risks associated with some pernicious Chinese investment. And we've largely blocked China from getting a foothold in the Arctic economic space over the last decade. I think we often talk about the attempts that China has made to come into the region and not look with enough sobriety at how successful we've been.
Let's see what Finland did with Huawei. You could see what the Greenland did with the investment in mining, things of that nature, I assume.
Absolutely. And in Canada, same thing. You know, a particular, it was a gold mine attempted acquisition by Shandong of a Canadian company that was blocked on national security grounds. Yes, gold is a strategic mineral, sure, but that wasn't the basis. It was that the geographic location would have been centrally Canadian Arctic, absolutely strategic. So we do have examples of states stepping in or other actors in the private sector stepping in and helping to deal with this. So again, there's China where we see also it generally complying with international law in much of its Arctic behavior. I think where we're really studying closely is when is it using lawfare? And again, it's not necessarily the Chinese state, it's not the People's Republic of China, but Chinese entities like the Nunu Polar Bear, that one, you know, vessel, Chinese flag, but also shared headquarters in Moscow, which tells us something, you know, going and dragging up those seabed cables in the Baltic. That's something we were awakened to as realizing that both in that sphere and also in terms of marine scientific research, China is conducting what we often refer to as dual use research, meaning it can also be used for military purposes. I always remind, you know, audiences as well, but we do that stuff too. Yeah. If they're undertaking it and not sharing that research as they're obliged to under international law, or are covert in the way that they're collecting it or not adhering to scientific permits or whatever, those are things we need to call them on. We also need to be really careful with China to distinguish between when they are behaving illegally or unlawfully and when they're behaving in ways that are distasteful or not aligned with our interests and rights. And I think the U.S. has done a really good job on that. Here's where I think U.S. leadership is really positive. When you look at certain activities by Russian-Chinese vessels, say crossing through the Aleutians and so on, being really clear that, yes, this is something that the U.S. has eyes on. We need to be present to meet presence with presence. But it's not that they're breaking international law. China would like nothing more for the U.S. to come and say that we're breaking. And then they could say, but you're doing the same sort of things in the South China Sea. So again, it requires a great degree of clarity and very, I think, methodical, deliberate strategic messaging to compete in this sphere.
So you mentioned a good point here in that much of what we point out, we being U.S. and Canada perhaps, or the West, you could probably phrase it both ways, that China is doing, and to the extent Russia perhaps, and again to kind of zero in geographically on the North Pacific for now, you mentioned the Aleutians and Chinese naval vessels being there with the Russians and then in the air as
Absolutely.
Well, that we do similar things in their backyard, South China Sea, Strait of Taiwan. Okay, I understand that. That's been happening for a while. And if you're in China, you might say, well, it shouldn't be happening and it shouldn't have been happening for a while. Okay, but the fact, the newness now is that it is happening. It being, we'll call it, you know, joint campaigning, partnered campaigning between Russia, with Russia and China in this part of the world. Is that a sign of something, and what might that be? Some might say, well, that's a shift. Are they signaling? Is it a sign that that the West is losing momentum? Because to use like a sports analogy, are they, Has the playing field kind of tilted a little bit? I'm not saying it's suddenly lopsided because there's still a lot of U.S. and allies and partner presence in the South China Sea and elsewhere, But this hasn't happened to this degree in a while, so I'm trying to figure out, are these one-off signaling measures, or is this a bigger shift in maybe something that might be indicating more normalizing of behavior?
So Matt, great, absolutely the question in my mind. So first of all, starting audience members, like, think of this as strategic signaling. These things happen, they happen for a reason at given time. So this is clearly sending the US and the West a message by having these joint activities going on, both in the maritime and air domain. So first of all, that's absolutely key. I think it's also important for us to maintain a semblance of chronology and understanding what we're doing, which I think is absent in most of the news stories and reporting on this. I see maybe a Russia that would prefer not to have China as its partner by necessity, because they have a lot of written piece in Joint Force Quarterly to say there are friction points. They're not natural. As you say, they're not allies. So first of all, I'd say that right away. There's no indication. There might be things that look like what we in the West enjoy as allies, but they don't have
some
that
common interests, maybe
trust.
Not common values.
So when I look at what's these new developments in terms of joint operations together, what is it that they are seeing as requiring them to actually work together? And from a Russian standpoint, it may mean that they don't have confidence that their abilities to strategic communicate their deterrent effects vis-a-vis NATO is not succeeding. So only by bundling their capabilities together can they try and send a signal that we need to be investing more resources in defending these North Pacific, and some might say Arctic. I'd say a lot of the signaling so far is more North Pacific. I also suggest that how we respond and how we read it, it requires a great degree of care. It may be that our competitors are wanting us to commit resources to the North Pacific or the Arctic, which of course ties up resources from being deployed elsewhere. So one of the things I've written with a colleague, Ryan Dean, a piece back in the day, was sort of thinking of Trojan dragons. What kind of activities might China be undertaking that really are not what they appear on face value? And we talked about the Arctic from a Chinese strategic standpoint as potentially being a diversionary theater.
Yeah.
So the idea being, if China were to develop, and they're struggling with their submarine capabilities, as some of us know, in recent in recent months, but were they deploying submarines into the Arctic? What would be their desired effect? Would it be to force us or encourage us, entice us to draw resources away from the South China Sea, their real center of gravity, meaning their real core interests? So thinking about the Arctic then in this more complex way, where, you know, increased Chinese presence, increased jointness between China and Russia is all a message of encouraging, as you said, for us to think about what are the different messages they're signaling? Are we getting it right? And then are we proportionate in our response?
Right.
Or we're not getting drawn away from what are, you know,
because a knee-jerk reaction could be, maybe it wouldn't be knee-jerk to some, but to others it might be, is to say, well, there's a joint naval patrol there, there's X amount of ships, the United States, others should send, have some sort of parity there, get naval vessels into the same area, run them off, and off we go. But those have to come from somewhere, is what you're saying. And the closer they are to home, the less you can project power elsewhere. And herein lies sort of offense, defense. We can get into theoretical concepts of what that might mean. And really, this kind of brings us sort of this big chessboard that the Arctic is part of. So last we kind of finish where we start. We started about, you know, threats to, through, and in mostly the North American Arctic, the Canadian Arctic, and the North American Arctic. And we end kind of back there by taking this detour around the world and saying, well, this is all connected in some way.
And if I may, like, thinking about the air threat to North America and NORAD, and again, this binational command means that when there was a balloon, you know, in the Yukon, it was actually an interceptor from Alaska that went and shot it down. Canada did have interceptors that were scrambled and flown up from Cold Lake. By virtue of the NORAD relationship, it's whoever gets there first will take the shot and shoot it down. To me, it was an example of how our partnership works very well. When we think about meeting presence, so presence of Chinese or Russian vessels with presence, Canada's bringing online our Arctic and offshore patrol vessels, the Harry DeWolf class, you know, which are ice capable. This is a way of complementing what a lot of US capabilities are, right? Where because of our relationship, because of this long-standing alliance, because we are premier partners, our ability to figure out what the right calibrated way is to meet that presence with presence, means that we can think in a more broad allied context. So I hope what Canada is doing and where we're moving towards and where we're resourcing is being that credible ally, which we've always been, but making sure we have the capabilities to maintain that and making sure that we are sharing the burden. And I don't think that's a, I think Dr. Extrapiro's comment was almost we're being told we have to do this. I hope it's the opposite.
Yeah.
I hope it's that we are wanting to be able to contribute that because we're a proud country and we've earned our place at the table with you. And by virtue of that, we bring the capabilities to make a meaningful contribution. I think what we're seeing is a pivot where the Arctic, Northern North America continental defense is returning to our collective understanding of this is an absolutely core theater, and it's one where a Canadian contribution is not going to be misread in Washington as us not wanting to take on our responsibilities globally. We're now seeing that by contributing to North American defense, we are contributing to global defense.
There's so much to get to. I think we're going to leave it at that for now. Dr. Whitney Lochenbauer, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks, Matt. Always a pleasure.
Come back again.